Thunder Butte by Virginia Driving Hawk Sneave. The sun was just beginning to rise when John woke Norman the next morning. "You must get an early start if you are going to the west side of the butte and return by supper," John said to the sleepy boy. "If you are not home by the time I get back from work, I'll come looking for you." Norman reluctantly rose. Last night, he had accepted his grandfather's command to go to the Thunder Butte without too many doubts. Yet now, in the morning's chill light, the boy wondered if his grandfather's dreams were the meaningless meanderings of an old mine, or if his grandfather was really worthy of the tribe's respect as one of the few remaining wise elders who understood the ancient ways. Norman dressed in his oldest clothes and pulled on worn and scuffed boots to protect his feet from the rocks and snakes of the butte. He heard his parents talking in the other room and knew his father was telling his mother where Norman was going. As the boy entered the room, which was kitchen and living room as well as his parents' bedroom, he heard his mother say, "What if there is a rock slide and Norman is hurt or buried on the butte? We won't know anything until you get home from work. John, I don't want Norman to go." "The boy is old enough to have learned to be careful on the butte. He'll be all right," John answered as he tried to reassure Sarah. "Besides," he added, "my father dreamed of this happening." Sarah grunted scornfully. "No one believes in dreams or in any of these old superstitious ways anymore." "I'll be okay, Mom," Norman said as he sat down at the table. "I should be able to find lots of agates on the west side where there is all that loose rock. Maybe I can talk the trader into giving me money for them after all." He spoke bravely despite his own inner misgivings about going to the butte. Sarah protested no more. Norman looked at her, but she lowered her head as she set a plate of pancakes in front of him. He knew she was hiding the worry she felt for him. John put on his hat and went to the door. "Don't forget to take the willow branch with you," he said to Norman, "and be careful." "Don't forget to take the willow branch with you," he said to Norman, "and be careful." Norman nodded and ate his breakfast. When he was finished, he stood up. "Guess I'll go," he said to his mother, who was pouring hot water from the tea kettle into her dishpan. When she didn't speak, Norman took the willow cane from where he had propped it up by the door and his hat from the nail above it. "Wait," Sarah called and handed him a paper bag. "Here is a lunch for you. You'll need something to eat since you'll be gone all day." She gave him an affectionate hug. "Oh, go on. I know you'll be all right. Like your dad said, you're old enough to be careful." Norman smiled at his mother. "Thanks," he said as he tucked the lunch into his shirt. He checked his back pocket to see if he remembered the salt bag to put the agates in. He walked briskly across the open prairie and turned to wave at his mother, who had come outside to watch him leave. She waved back and Norman quickened his pace. He whistled, trying to echo the meadowlarks who were greeting the day with their happy song. He swiped the willow cane at the bushy sage and practiced spearing the pear cactus that dotted his path. The early morning air was cool, but the sun soon warmed the back of his neck, and he knew it would be a hot day. He crossed the creek south of where Matt Two Bulls tent was pitched, and then he was climbing the gentle beginning slope of the butte. He stopped and studied the way before him and wondered if it wouldn't be easier to reach the west side by walking around the base of the butte, even though it would be longer. Then Norman smiled as he remembered his grandfather's command to climb the south trail that wound to the top. He decided to do what the old man wanted. The ascent sharply steepened, and the sun rose with him as Norman climbed. What looked like a smooth path from the prairie floor was rough, rocky terrain. The trail spiraled up a sharp incline, and Norman had to detour around fallen rocks. He paused to rest about halfway up and then saw how sharply the overhanging ledge of the butte protruded. Getting to the top of it was going to be a difficult struggle. He climbed on. His foot slipped and his ankle twisted painfully. Small pebbles bounced down the slope and he saw a rattlesnake slither out of the way. He tightly clutched the willow branch and leaned, panting against the butte. He sighed with relief as the snake crawled out of sight. He wiggled his foot until the pain left his ankle. Then he started to trudge up the incline again. At last, only the ledge of the butte loomed over him. There appeared to be no way up. Disgusted that his laborious climb seemed dead-ended, he stubbornly tried to reach the top. Remembering the courage of the ancient young men who had struggled in the same place to gain the summit and seek their visions, he was determined not to go back. His fingers found tiny cracks to hold on to. The cane was cumbersome and in the way. He was tempted to drop it, but he thought of the snake he'd seen and struggled on, with it awkwardly under his arm. Finally, Norman spied a narrow opening in the ledge, which tapered down to only a few feet from where he clung. He inched his way up until he reached the base of the opening, and then he found a use for the cane. He jammed the stout branch high into the boulders above him. Cautiously, he pulled to see if it would hold his weight. It held. Using the cane as a lever, he pulled himself to the top. This final exertion winded the boy, and he lay exhausted on the summit, boots hanging over the edge. Cautiously, he pulled his feet under him, stood, and looked around. He gazed at a new world. The sun bathed the eastern valley in pale yellow, which was spotted with dark clumps of sage. The creek was a green and silver serpent winding its way to the southeast. His grandfather's tent was a white shoebox in its clearing, and beside it stood a diminutive form waving a red flag. It was Matt Tubal, signaling with his shirt, and Norman knew that his grandfather had been watching him climb. He waved his hat in reply and then walked to the outer edge of the butte. The summit was not as smoothly flat as it looked from below. Norman stepped warily over the many cracks and holes that pitted the surface. He was elated that he had successfully made the difficult ascent. But now, as he surveyed the butte top, he had a sense of discomfort. There were burn scars on the rough summit, and Norman wondered if these spots were where the lightning had struck, or were they evidence of ancient man-made fires. He remembered that this was a sacred place to the old ones, and his uneasiness increased. He longed to be back on the secure level of the plains. On the west edge, he saw the butte cast a sharp shadow below because the rim protruded as sharply as it had on the slope he climbed. Two flat rocks jutted up on either side of a narrow opening, and Norman saw shallow steps hewn into the space between. This must be the trail of which his grandfather had spoken. Norman stepped down and then quickly turned to hug the butte face as the steps ended abruptly in space. The rest of the rocky staircase lay broken and crumbled below. The only way down was to jump. He cautiously let go of the willow branch and watched how it landed and bounced against the rocks. He took a deep breath as if to draw courage from the air. He lowered himself so that he was hanging by his fingertips to the last rough step, closed his eyes, and dropped. The impact of his landing stung the soles of his feet. He stumbled and felt the cut of the sharp rocks against one knee as he struggled to retain his balance. He did not fall and finally stood upright, breathing deeply until the wild pounding of his heart slowed. "Wow," he said softly as he looked back up at the ledge. "That must have been at least a 20-foot drop." He picked up the willow branch and started walking slowly down the steep slope. The trail Matt Tubal had told him about had been obliterated by years of falling rock. Loose shale and gravel shifted under Norman's feet, and he probed cautiously ahead with the cane to test the firmness of each step. He soon found stones which he thought were agates. He identified them by splitting on each rock and rubbing the wet spot with his finger. The dull rock seemed to come alive. Variegated hues of brown and gray glowed as if polished. They were agates, all right. Quickly, he had his salt bag half full. It was almost noon when his stomach growled. He stopped to rest against a large boulder and pulled out his lunch from his shirt. But his mouth was too dry to chew the cheese sandwich. He couldn't swallow without water. Thirsty and hungry, Norman decided to go straight down the butte and head for home. Walking more confidently as the slope leveled out, he thrust the pointed cane carelessly into the ground. He suddenly fell as the cane went deep into the soft shale. Norman slid several feet. Loose rocks rolled around him as he came to rest against a boulder. He lay still for a long time, fearing that his tumble might cause a rock fall. But no thundering slide came, so he cautiously climbed back to where the tip of the willow branch protruded from the ground. He was afraid that the cane may have plunged into a rattlesnake den. Carefully, he pulled at the stout branch, wiggling it this way and that with one hand while he dug with the other. It came loose, sending a shower of rocks down the hill, and Norman saw that something else was sticking up in the hole he had uncovered. Curious and seeing no sign of snakes, he kept digging and soon found the tip of a leather-covered stick. Bits of leather and wood fell off in his hand as he gently pulled. The stick, almost as long as he was tall and curved on one end, emerged as he tugged. Holding it before him, his heart pounding with excitement, he realized that he had found a thing that once belonged to the old ones. Norman shivered at the thought that he may have disturbed a grave, which was Tahinda, forbidden. He cleared more dirt away but saw no bones nor other signs that this was a burial place. Quickly he picked up the stick and his willow cane and hurried down the hill. When he reached the bottom, he discovered that in his fall, the salt bag of agates had pulled loose from his belt, but he did not return to search for it. It would take most of the afternoon to travel around the base of the butte to the east side. The creek was in the deep shade of the butte when he reached it and thirstily flopped down and drank. He crossed the shallow stream and walked to his grandfather's tent. "You have been gone a long time," Matt Tuble greeted as Norman walked into the clearing where the old man was seated. "I have come from the west side of the butte, Grandpa," Norman said wearily. He sat down on the ground and examined a tear in his jeans and a bruise on his knee. "Was it difficult?" the old man asked. "Yes," Norman nodded. He told of the rough climb up the south slope, the jump down, and finally of his fall, which led him to discover the long leather-covered stick. He held the stick out to his grandfather, who took it and examined it carefully. "Are you sure there was no body in the place where you found this?" Norman shook his head. "No, I found nothing else but the stick. Do you know what it is, Grandpa?" "You have found a coo stick, which belonged to the old ones. I know that it is old because the wood is brittle and the leather is peeling. But what was a coo stick?" Norman asked. "In the days when the old ones roamed all of the plains," the old man swept his hands in a circle, "a courageous act of valor was thought to be more important than killing an enemy. When a warrior rode or ran up to his enemy, close enough to touch the man with the stick, without killing or being killed, the action was called coup. The French, the first white men in this part of the land, named this brave deed coup. In their language, the word meant hit or strike. The special stick, which was used to strike with, came to be known as a coup stick. Some sticks were long like this one." Matt Tuble held the stick upright. "Some were straight and others had a curve on the end, like the sheep's herder's crooks." "Some sticks were long like this one." Matt Tuble held the stick upright. "Some were straight and others had a curve on the end, like the sheep herder's crook." He pointed to the curving end of the stick. "The sticks were decorated with fur or painted leather strips. A warrior kept count of his coups by tying an eagle feather to the crook for each brave deed. See?" He pointed to the staff end. "Here is a remnant of a tie thong which must have once held a feather." The old man and boy closely examined the coup stick. Matt Tuble traced with his fingers the faint zigzag design painted on the stick. "See?" he said. "It is the thunderbolt." "What does that mean?" Norman asked. "The thunders favored a certain few of the young men who sought their vision on the butte. The thunderbolt may have been part of a sacred dream sent as a token of the thunder's favor. If this was so, the young man could use the thunderbolt symbol on his possessions." "How do you suppose the stick came to be on the butte?" Norman asked. His grandfather shook his head. "No one can say. Usually such a thing was buried with a dead warrior, as were his weapons and other prized belongings." "Is the coup stick what you dreamed about, Grandpa?" "No. In my dream, I only knew that you were to find a wakan, a holy thing, but I did not know what it would be." Norman laughed nervously. "What do you mean, wakan? Is this stick haunted?" Matt Tuble smiled. "No, not like you mean in a fearful way, but in a sacred manner because it once had great meaning to the old ones." "But why should I have been the one to find it?" Norman questioned. His grandfather shrugged. "Perhaps to help you understand the ways, the values of the old ones." "But nobody believes in that kind of thing anymore," Norman scoffed. "And even if people did, I couldn't run out and hit my enemy with a stick and get away with it." He smiled, thinking of Mr. Brannan. "No one would think I was brave. I'd probably just get thrown in jail." Suddenly, Norman felt compelled to stop talking. In the distance, he heard a gentle rumble, which seemed to come from the butte. He glanced up at the hill looming high above and saw that it was capped with dark, low-hanging clouds. Matt Tuble looked too and smiled. "The thunders are displeased with your thoughts," he said to Norman. "Listen to their message." A sharp streak of lightning split the clouds and the thunder cracked and echoed over the plains. Norman was frightened, but he answered with bravado. "The message I get is that a storm is coming. but his voice betrayed him by quavering. "Maybe you better come home with me, Grandpa. Your tent will get soaked through if it rains hard."
"No," murmured Matt Tuble. "No rain will come. It is just the thunder speaking."
There was another spark of lightning and an explosive reverberation sounded as if in agreement with the old man. Norman jumped to his feet.
"Well, I'm going home. Mom will be worried because I'm late now."
He turned to leave.
"Wait," Matt Tuble commanded. "Take the acoustic with you."
Norman backed away.
"No, I don't want it. You can have it."
The old man rose swiftly despite the stiffness of his ears and sternly held out the stick to the boy.
"You found it. It belongs to you. Take it."
Norman slowly reached out his hands and took the stick. "Even if you think the old ways are only superstition and the stick no longer has meaning, it is all that remains of an old life and must be treated with respect." Matt Tuble smiled at the boy. "Take it," he repeated gently, "and hang it in the house where it will not be handled." Norman hurried home as fast as he could, carrying the long stick in one hand and the willow cane in the other. He felt vaguely uneasy and somehow a little frightened. It was only when he reached the security of his home that he realized the thunder had stopped and there had been no storm.
"Mom,"
he called as he went into the house.
"I'm home."
His mother was standing at the stove.
"Oh, Norman," she greeted him, smiling.
"I'm glad you're back. I was beginning to worry." Her welcoming smile turned to a frown as she saw the acoustic in Norman's hand.
"What is that?"
"Grandpa says it's acoustic. Here," Norman handed it to her. "Take a look at it. It's interesting the way it's made and
"No," Sarah interrupted and backed away from him. "I won't touch that heathen thing no matter what it is. Get it out of the house."
"What?" Norman asked, surprised and puzzled. "There's nothing wrong with it. It's just an old stick I found up on the butte."
"I don't care," Sarah insisted. "I won't have such a thing in the house."
"But Mom," Norman protested, "it's not like we believe in those old ways the way Grandpa does." But Sarah was adamant. "Take it out of the house," she ordered, pointing to the door. "We'll talk about it when your dad gets home." Reluctantly, Norman took the acoustic outside and gently propped it against the house and sat on the steps to wait for his father. He was confused, first by his grandfather's reverent treatment of the acoustic as if it were a sacred object, and then by Sarah's rejection of it as a heathen symbol. He looked at the stick where it leaned against the wall and shook his head. So much fuss over a brittle, rotten length of wood. Even though he had gone through a lot of hard, even dangerous effort to get it, he was now tempted to leave it, to heave it out on the trash pile. Norman wearily leaned his head against the house. He suddenly felt tired and his knee ached. As he sat wearily rubbing the bruise, John Tuble rode the old mare into the yard. Norman got up and walked back to the shed to help unsaddle the horse. John climbed stiffly out of the saddle. His faded blue work shirt and jeans were stained with perspiration and dirt. His boots were worn and scuffed.
"Hard day, Dad?" Norman asked.
"Yeah," John answered, slipping the bridle over the mare's head. "Rustlers got away with 20 steers last night. I spent the day counting head and mending fences. Whoever the thief was cut the fence, drove a truck right onto the range, and loaded the cattle without being seen." He began rubbing the mare down as she munched the hay in her manger.
"How did your day on the butte go?" John asked.
"Rough," Norman answered. "I'm beat, too." The climb to the butte was tough, and coming down was bad, too. He told his father all that had happened on the butte, winding up with the climax of his falling and finding the old acoustic. John listened attentively and did not interrupt until Norman told of Matt Tuble's reaction to the stick.
"I think Grandpa's mind has gotten weak," Norman said. "He really believes that the acoustic has some sort of mysterious power and that the thunders were talking."
"Don't make fun of your grandfather," John reprimanded, "or of the old ways he believes in."
"Okay, okay," Norman said quickly, not wanting another scolding.
"But Mom is just the opposite from Grandpa," he went on. "She doesn't want the acoustic in the house. Says it's heathen." He walked to the house and handed the stick to his father. John examined it and then carried it into the house.
"John!" Sarah exclaimed as she saw her husband bring the stick into the room. "I told Norman and I tell you that I won't have that heathenish thing in the house."
But John ignored her and propped the stick against the door while he pulled his toolbox out from under the washstand to look for a hammer and nails.
"John!" Sarah persisted. "Did you hear me?"
"I heard," John answered quietly, but Norman knew his father was angry.
and I don't want to hear any more." Norman was surprised to hear his father speak in such a fashion. John was slow to anger, usually spoke quietly and tried to avoid conflict of any kind. But now he went on. "This," he said, holding the coup stick upright, "is a relic of our people's past glory, when it was a good thing to be an Indian. It is a symbol of something that shall never be again." Sarah gasped and stepped in front of her husband as he started to climb a chair to pound the nails in the wall above the window. "But that's what I mean," she said. "Those old ways were just superstition. They don't mean anything now. They can't, because such a way of life can't be anymore. We don't need to have those old symbols of heathen ways hanging in the house." She grabbed the coup stick, but John jerked it out of her reach. "Don't touch it," he shouted, and Sarah fell back against the table in shocked surprise. Norman took a step forward as if to protect his mother. The boy had never seen his father so angry. John shook his head as if to clear it. "Sarah, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to yell. It's just that the old ones would not permit a woman to touch such a thing as this." He handed Norman the stick to hold while he hammered the nails in the wall. Then he hung the stick above the window. "Sarah," he said as he put the tools away, "think of the stick as an object that could be in a museum, a part of history. It's not like we were going to fall down on our knees and pray to it." His voice was light and teasing as he tried to make peace. But Sarah stood stiffly at the stove preparing supper and would not answer. Norman felt sick. His appetite was gone. When his mother set a plate of food before him, he excused himself, saying, "I guess I'm too tired to eat," and went to his room. But after he had undressed and crawled into bed, he couldn't sleep. His mind whirled with the angry words his parents had spoken. They had never argued in such a way before. "I wish I had never brought that old stick home," he whispered, and then pulled the pillow over his head to shut out the sound of the low rumble of thunder that came from the west.